Now we good?
Yep.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this almost a fine day, not quite, April 6, 2015. We're going to change the order of the lineup a little bit. We have some people who have quite a drive to get home, so I will open a work session first on House Bill 2278, the Coos Bay Channel Project. I think what I'd like to do is have Mr. Brennan just give us a very quick overview, and then I'll invite Mr. Kosh up to give us just a little bit lengthier, not lengthy, overview about what we're voting on today. So, Mr. Brennan.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2278, we heard this on the 13th. It modifies the schedule and conditions for issuance of water bonds to pay the cost of the Coos Bay Channel project. It has an emergency clause. It will be effective upon passage and signature by the governor. We have before us a Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 amendment clarifies that the measure applies to agencies or organizations acting as financial contributors, clarifies legislative findings, makes go. Oh, I guess I can let Mr. Koch speak to that.
I think that would be wise.
I will point out, however, that this measure came to us with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and so that will be where it will end up after it leaves our committee, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Koch. Welcome to our committee.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is David Kosh. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Port of Coos Bay, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about the Dash 2 amendments for House Bill 2278. This House bill is a continuation of a House bill that was adopted during the 2007 legislative session, where the state pledged support to the Coos Bay Channel Modification Project that we initiated at that time through a study with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. House Bill 2278 contains updates to the language of that bill that recognizes the change in federal authority that we are pursuing the Channel Modification Project under from Section 203 of the Water Resources and Development Act of 1986 to Section 204 of that same act. In doing so, in changing the authority that we are pursuing the Channel Modification Project under, it changed several of the milestones and key decision points that the federal agency, in this case the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, has to undertake prior to giving final authorization to the port to commence with the additional deepening and widening of the Coos Bay Channel. We are coming to you today with the bill for the to amend the milestones that are contained within the original bill, as well as to push off a portion of the funding that was pledged towards this next phase of the project that we are getting ready to enter into. This July, we are targeted for meeting the tentatively selected plan milestone with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. That is the milestone where we will designate how deep and how wide the channel project will be constructed. That's based on primarily a series of economic studies that are underway right now with the Corps of Engineers at their Deep Draft Center of Expertise in Mobile, Alabama, that will identify where the cost-benefit ratio comes out between the cost of doing the project and the benefits, national economic benefits that come from the enhancements to the national transportation system from these improvements to the Coos Bay Channel. Once we identify that tentatively selected plan and the Corps confirms through a memorandum for the record, we move into the next phase of design, we've done preliminary design, moves forward in the process of design, engineering, initial permitting for that project. During the upcoming biennium, under the project schedule, we don't need the entire $15 million that was pledged for that phase. We'll only complete about $10 million of that work during the upcoming biennium, so we've pushed five of that 15 to the next biennium to free that up within the budget, because we know we won't need to tap into that. And then it also adjusts the date where we would begin construction and the $40 million pledge for construction. I would note that those are a portion of the total project costs. The balance of the project costs are being provided by the port through project funding agreements we have with project sponsors, and that's a model that we've used as we've gone along from the beginning with this project. to make up for the difference. So the state is not pledging 100% of the project costs here. It's simply a portion of those project costs that move us down the road. And I can stand for questions on any of the amendments that are before you today.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Koch. This is a long, arduous process to do any kind of channel modification. We've already been in this process, I think, down at the Port of Coos Bay for
8 years.
8 years now, and it will be a ways down the road before this happens. But this is just one more step along the way to keep the project moving. So thank you. Are there any questions for our port director?
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Sure. Koch. Appreciate you being here. Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, I move that the -2 amendment to House Bill 2278 be adopted.
Vice Chair Davis moves to adopt House Bill 2278-2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2278 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 2278 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, would you call the roll?
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative
Dentz? Aye.
Representative
Devine? Yes.
Chair McKinney?
Aye. The motion carries. And this will be moved down to Ways and Means. So thank you very much. Now I will move to open a public hearing on House Bill 3193 and once again turn to Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3193. This is our first hearing on the bill. It's increased the license tax on leaded aircraft fuel by an unspecified amount. It's currently blank in the measure and provides for annual increases also by an unspecified amount on January 1st of each following year. It applies the sales, use, or distribution of leaded aircraft fuel on or after the effective date, and the effective date would be the 91st day following adjournment signing die. Since we have received this measure did not come to us with a subsequent referral, but the Speaker has requested if the committee move the bill forward that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. I believe Representative Greenlick is here to speak to the bill. Thank you for being here, Representative. We have a number of people lined up behind you, but we'd love to hear from you first.
Can I get back to judiciary? Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Greenlick. I'm a state representative from House District 33, which includes Northwest Portland and a chunk of Northeast Washington County. This bill came out of discussions and some hearings that we've been having in the interim on the whole question of air quality and air pollution. As I'm sure you all know, we've removed lead from most gasoline products because it was a major source of putting lead into the environment. But the one exception to that has been a certain amount of aviation fuel, particularly fuel for single engine piston-driven airplanes. And that fuel that's used in those kind of airplanes contains lead. The result of that in certain airports is that the airports are the major source of lead pollution in the environment, causing identifiable problems in the environment around airports such as Hillsborough and Troutdale as two, for example. The problem with leaded aviation fuel is that those airports are training airports. At least Hillsborough is a training airport. So it isn't just a matter of putting fuel in the plane and having it take off. It's a matter of constant during the day, takeoff and landing, touch and goes as a part of the process. And consequently, the major source of lead pollution in the whole state is surrounding the Hillsborough Airport. I'm getting reports now from the medical facilities around that area that there is children showing up with lead poisoning from no other obvious source. The assumption being it's the high degree of lead in the air around those airports that are leaching out and causing problems with kids. There are alternatives to leaded aviation fuel, and we heard in testimony in hearing Senator Dembro and I had in Portland during the interim that there are no market forces that are pushing people to move to the alternative aviation fuel. So there, and there is some movement towards ultimately getting toward alternatives to leaded avgas, but there's no real push for them. It seemed to me it would be useful to create some market forces, since there are going to be, there are alternatives now and there are going to be more alternatives in the future, to produce gas that works well for single-engine piston-driven airplanes. So I propose a tax, and I was surprised the bill wasn't referred to revenue. I left those numbers blank because I assumed it would need to go to revenue, obviously, and I hope what you'll do is move it on to revenue to let them think about it. The notion was to start with a very modest aviation leaded fuel tax to begin with, and to increase that over the next 6 or 8 years, to move it to where there are market forces that move people to alternatives to leaded aviation fuel. I think this is an important public health issue, which is why we had those hearings around public health, and I would urge you to consider it. There are, you have materials on both sides of this issue in OLIS. I would urge you to consider it and to move it over to the Committee on Revenue.
Right. Thank you so much, Representative. Do we have questions for Representative Greenlick? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. I think you stated that it doesn't look like there are any forces potentially moving to the phase-out of leaded aviation fuel, but...
There are some forces, but they're moving slowly.
Okay, and one of those, I think, is EPA is looking at this. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have 14 people signed up to testify on this bill at this point. So what I would like to do is invite people up in teams of three. And if you could hold your comments to a couple of minutes, I'd be very grateful. We have other bills after this, too, so we need to constrain our time just a little bit so everyone has a chance to speak. First, I'd like to call up Mary Rosenblum, Alan Alexander, and Terry Coleman. Thank you for being here today, in no particular order, just in any order you choose. Welcome.
I'm Madam Chair and mm-hmm. our committee members. Mary Rosenblum, I am president of Oregon Pilots Association and a resident of Canby, Oregon at Dietz Air Park. And I would very much like to speak to this bill. We all fly planes, and there are 7,600 registered aircraft in this state, 8,600 pilots. And there isn't a single one of these aircraft that does not provide an economic benefit to this state, to the tune of $846 million in labor and $3 billion.
I'm going to stop you for just mm-hmm. a second. If you would move back from the mic just a little
bit. Is that better?
A little bit more.
How's
there.
That?
If you get too close, it distorts it. So,
got it.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
It's hard for me to hear what I'm doing over the mic. All right.
As long as we hear, you're good.
Yes. Yeah. So the issue is lead, and we're very aware that there's lead in our aviation fuel, and the misleading statements that we frequently hear is major source of lead. It is a major source because it's effectively the only source, but major source does not mean it is a large source. Lead is not a good thing. We understand it. We're immersed in it perhaps more than anyone else because we're flying these planes. And in 2013, I attended a meeting at Hillsborough Airport where there is a lot of training activity, as Representative Greenlick stated. And at that point, the Oregon Department of Public Health was there, the Environmental and Quality, DEQ, was there. And both departments stated unequivocally that while they were seeing lead in blood in children in the Hillsborough Airport, these were traceable in every instance to house paint, which is a major source of lead contamination. And they did not at that time feel and have not since stated that lead emissions from Hillsborough traffic is a dangerous source of lead contamination to children. What we're seeing is if this bill goes through, What we will do is effectively punish pilots who are flying these piston aircraft, and that is about 70% of our fleet, our GA fleet, is using piston-powered aircraft. The problem with simply saying stop using it is that it causes, in high-compression engines, which are about 30% of these flights, of these aircraft, detonation, which can cause the engine to tear itself apart at several thousand feet over the Rocky Mountains. Not good for the pilot, not good for anybody under the pilot.
Right.
So we already have aircraft that are capable of flying with unleaded, with ethanol-free aviation, with ethanol-free car gas. And certainly making this more available through subsidies to people to put in tanks and dispense this fuel would certainly make it more widely used. There is also a program in place with the FAA, the Piston Aviation Fuel Initiative, which in 2018, which is 3 years from now, will have fuel available for purchase without any lead that can be used by these high compression engines. Already, Swift Fuel, Shell, and one other provider are testing four of these fuels without any lead in them in flying aircraft. And this is the final stage of a very safety conscious and extensive testing. The last thing we want is a light a business craft twin propeller engine with six people on board to go down with an engine failure. And the FAA is being highly safety conscious, but we're looking at a 3-year window before we can remove these fuels. So what we're looking at is a punitive impact on a number of people with a problem that will go away in 3 years.
Great. Thank you so much.
Go ahead.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chairman McGowan and other members.
It's McEwen. I'll just say to the world, it happens all the time. You get a pass. Thank you.
I'm Alan Alexander. I represent I'm the executive director of the Oregon Airport Pilots, the Oregon Airport Managers Association. And we've got some very concerns, even though our primary focus is on airports and their management and their development. We have some concerns as an organization with the possible consequences of House Bill 3193. While all the parties are interested in finding a viable alternative to 100 low lead, the fuel problem is complex and there's no easy drop-in fuel replacement fuel that has been identified. The aviation fueling industry, with research funding from the FAA, has been working towards a safe alternative fuel for some time. Since 2010, significant progress has been made in finding an acceptable fuel that the FAA has identified, and they have identified four possible fuels, as Mary indicated earlier. And these are in a phase one testing right now. Phase two testing, including flight testing, is scheduled through 2017, and the FAA is mandated to select at least one of these alternative fuels for certification by 2018. The process of certification is lengthy. It focuses on safety, and it focuses on a fuel mix that is viable for a high-compression engine at all operating routines. So that's the reason it's taking so long to get something that's going to work. Currently, there is no replacement fuel for high-compression engines that doesn't have contain some modicum of lead. 2013 attempts to reduce the use of 100 low lead by financially punishing the aircraft owners, the impact of which would be an adverse impact on Oregon-based line service companies, many of whom are small businesses and are dependent upon fuel sales to be successful in their business. While many operators of light aircraft have converted to the use of automotive fuel, the lower octane rating of automotive fuel prohibits its use in high-performance engines. For those aircraft that are only approved for safe and the only approved and safe and available fuel is 100 low lead. SB 3193 calls for a license tax on each gallon sold with an annual unspecified increase. The bill does not specify how the tax would be used. Such a tax would drive up the operating cost of Oregon-based aircraft. Most of these aircraft requiring 100 low lead are used in businesses, especially charter and air taxi operations. Increasing the operating costs will only make these operators less competitive and could drive them out of to relocate the aircraft out of state or simply purchase their fuel out of state. Both practices would hurt Oregon businesses and airports without any discernible environmental relief. If the purpose of this proposed legislation truly is to reduce the atmospheric lead content, why not join with the fueling industry and the FAA and the EPA and let them complete the process of approving and certifying a lead-free alternative fuel? thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Committee Chair Kathy McEwen and committee members, my name is Terry Coleman, and I'm co-owner and operator of Air Haven, Inc., located at Lenhart Air Park. We're 3 miles east of Hubbard, Oregon. I am in opposition to House Bill 3193, which increases taxes on leaded aviation fuel. Air Haven has over 100 small aircraft based at Lenhart Air Park. Contrary to popular belief, the majority of the owners of these aircraft are not rich. These aircraft owners are, for the most part, retired or average income individuals who have made flying and enjoying their aircraft a priority in their life. A majority of these aircraft owners have chosen to forgo purchasing brand new vehicles and the latest and greatest vacation destination in favor of purchasing avgas for their plane and flying to destinations for the afternoon or sometimes the weekend. Increasing taxes on leaded aviation fuel will decrease these individuals' fuel consumption, therefore decreasing money going into our economy. As it is now, general aviation contributes over $3 billion a year to the Oregon economy. It makes no sense to raise taxes on aviation fuel so that pilots purchase less fuel and therefore less money is generated in our state. The amount of lead added to the environment by general aviation is very small and not considered a health risk by any state or federal environmental or public health agency. The FAA is already working to find an alternative to leaded aviation fuel anyway, and HB 3193 does nothing to even facilitate that effort. As well as being a co-operator of Air Haven at Lenhart Air Park, I'm a pilot and the co-founder of a group of women who call themselves the Willamette Valley Fly Girls. This group of females fly monthly to various locations around Oregon and enjoy a meal together. I've gotten to know a lot of these gals fairly well flying with them over the last 2 years, and I know that a large majority of them will purchase less fuel, and they'll fly less frequently, yet the cost of fuel is higher. They simply won't be able to afford it. Females comprise only 6% of all pilots, which make us a minority group. Myself and others have been working hard on promoting aviation to women to increase the percentage of female aviators, and the additional increase in aviation fuel price that House Bill 3193 would create will directly negatively affect this female minority group. House Bill 3193 would be terrible for the Oregon economy, and it's a bad idea that would negatively affect retired individuals and a female minority group. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Next, we'll call up J. Ron Burgess, Brent Anderson, and Joel Crane. We'd also make the request that if you have written testimony, that you please do not read it to us. You submit that to us either electronically or by giving it to our committee assistant, who will get it to us, and speak to us as you're giving testimony. We also have two additional hearings today after this hearing, and we do have guests from out of town who traveled quite a distance for those hearings. So with that in mind, we're going to keep everybody to 3 minutes testifying, and I'm going to keep a timer at this point. If someone has said something that you agree with already, we invite you to agree with them and not say it again. But with that, we welcome your testimony. You may go in any order.
Thank you, Mr. Davis and fellow committee members. My name is Ryan Bourgeois. I'm an attorney from Canby, Oregon, and I live on a residential air park, Dietz Air Park in Clackamas County. I'm a longtime member of the Experimental Aircraft Association and local chapter EAA 105, which is based at the Twin Oaks Air Park in Washington County. I'm the guy that cooks the grits at the first Saturday of the month, pancake and grits breakfast at Twin Oaks. We've been holding that every year since every month since 1994. I operate what I submit is the quintessential Oregon aircraft. It's an RV-4. Designed by Richard Van Grunsven of North Plains, Oregon, and I built it from a kit manufactured by his company, Van's Aircraft, which is a major employer on the Aurora Airport. My aircraft has a Lycoming 320 engine in it. It's fuel injected. It's got high compression pistons, and it's one of those airplanes that I cannot operate without the 100LL. The 100LL has three characteristics that autogas doesn't have, It's got tetraethyl lead in it, which is an octane booster. That's what's causing the furor. You can operate it in a high compression aircraft or engine, any high compression engine, without having damaging detonation. What happens is the low octane fuel, it'll ignite before the piston reaches top dead center, and it'll detonate and explode as the piston's going up, and it can cause the engine to fail. 100LL also is more resistant to vapor lock than MoGas or ethanol auto gas, so you're not going to have to worry about the fuel boiling. It's less resistant to fuel boiling in the lines and stopping the fuel, the flow of fuel, and it also has additives that prevents the engine from the fuel from going stale. So it's the type of fuel that I've got to have to operate in my airplane, so I feel I'm justified in asking, what's the purpose of this bill? It doesn't appear to be to raise revenue. They don't have an amount in the bill. They don't say what the revenue is going to be used for, like maybe funding the Oregon Department of Aviation. Pilots will be paying the tax. Are you going to use it to fund the Oregon Department of Aviation, or are you going to use the revenues to subsidize fixed base operators who might want to move MoGas onto the airport, which aircraft with low compression engines can technically use, although the ones that are certified in the normal category still have to get an STC from the FAA to do so. But that's that would be an aviation purpose for the revenue, but I don't see any of that in the bill. So it doesn't seem to be a revenue-generating bill. It doesn't appear to be aimed at spurring the development of alternative fuels either, because that's already in the works. The FAA is already doing that. They're undergoing tests and studies right now to develop an alternative aviation fuel that can be used in these engines, and they're trying to get it done by 2018. So this bill is not necessary to do that. Maybe they're trying to deter use of a leaded fuel in avgas in the meantime. But why now? That decision was made, the cost-benefit analysis was done nationally years ago by the EPA and the legislatures who phased out leaded fuel in auto gas, and they'd made the cost, they did the cost-benefit analysis back then, that the amount of fuel that is used in aircraft and leaded fuel used in aircraft does not put out enough lead to pose a significant risk, and that's why they excluded aviation fuel from the prohibition. And nothing's changed since then. I haven't seen the EPA or the FAA or anybody else come up with a study that says, well, now we recognize that the health risk is significant enough to justify the cost of rendering so many engines obsolete. So it's not, I don't think it's to really a valid means of eliminating leaded avgas in the meantime.
We're in about 4 minutes now, so if you could wrap up.
Okay. So, but I think the real purpose is to deter aviation activity. And I think that's the real purpose of this bill, is just to make it too expensive for pilots to fly. And is that something you want to do? Do you want to deter aviation activity? And why would you want to do that? It's part of our transportation infrastructure, and it's a traditional activity in Oregon. We've got a proud aviation tradition in this state. It's the home of George Bogardus. It's the home of Richard Van Grunsven. We've got the Vans aircraft here. We've got Ben here. Oregon used to give its own pilot's licenses. So why do you want to deter aviation activity in the state of Oregon? Why would you want to do that? And that appears to be the purpose of this bill, is to deter aviation activity. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you.
I didn't expect to be speaking today. I just showed up. And my name is Joel Crane. I'm from Tigard. About 8 years ago, I flew my Beechcraft from Florida to Oregon. I loved the place so much. I bought a house, and this is where I live now. I love the place. I have a son who is moving up in his years now, but back then he was in his early 30s, and he wanted to be an airline pilot. And the reason I had my airplane here was for him to fly it. And the The price of fuel at that time was somewhat lower, but it's now up at the airport where I fly out of, it's pushing $5 a gallon. That's enough. And it's very discouraging for the young people who wanted to learn how to fly and join aviation and become productive in aviation to afford to pay for lessons. And for this reason, and it's not the fault of the pilots that we have lead in the gasoline. It was the federal government that decided that it was, the impact would be very small, if any. And I heard some data. Actually, it wasn't data from an individual who spoke to you early on, and he didn't support it with any evidence that I could hear. There was no substantial evidence. And I think this is just a way to raise revenue for the state, and there's no representation for the pilots. There's no return for the pilots. So I think we can find other ways of raising money. Let's not pick on the pilots. Like I said earlier, I did come from Florida, but I've been in aviation, flying airplanes for 60 years. I've been on every facet of aviation. I've been an airline pilot. I've been an FAA inspector. I've been a general aviation pilot. I've done everything there is to do in an airplane. And I've never seen a group that wants to raise the taxes for the aviator. It's just on the basis of lead in the gasoline that they have no control over. And I understand in just a few years it's going to be wiped out anyway. I might also add that the present engines that we have, nearly all the airplanes and piston engines will be ruined if we take the lead out of the gasoline. They're not designed to fly that way. I put a new engine in my airplane, and it must run on low lead gasoline. And it's not my choice that it had to be that way. So please vote against this bill. It's not the way to raise revenue. Find some other way. Don't pick on the pilot group. Thank you.
Thank you. And exceptionally well-timed. 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
You got 10 more left. You want to go for it?
I'd like to have his 10 seconds. My name's Brent Anderson.
And if you could all push the mic back just a little bit. You can be about 12 to 18 inches, and we can hear you just fine.
I am a aircraft builder, an aircraft owner, and a pilot. I've based my aircraft at Hillsboro, where I've been flying for the last 36 years. I fly the same type of aircraft as Ryan does here. It's an RV-4. And I feel very strongly opposed to this measure. Some of the things that have been mentioned, there really is no evidence that there's any lead pollution of significance coming from aircraft. Only 1% of the population are pilots. And if you think about the amount of airplanes flying around, you don't see them nose to tail like you do trucks and cars on I-5. How many planes do you see in the sky when you're driving down I-5? There are very few, and so there isn't any basis for that air pollution argument. There is a powerful push for the alternative fuels, as has been mentioned by several people, and in the letter that was written by AOPA that talked about the Piston Aviation Fuel Initiative. So I don't need to cover that. But I would like to say that one thing that hasn't been mentioned, even if there were attacks that were justified, the FAA mandates that tax be used for aviation purposes. That's a federal law. It can't be used for anything else. And this bill says nothing about that. Getting back to punishing the aviation community, aviation's always been expensive ever since the Wright brothers flew. Even at this point in time, when we have low fuel costs in cars because of the glut of oil that's coming from Saudi Arabia and the fracking industry, avgas costs $5 a gallon. And fuel cost is a major driver for aviators. Like many aviators, I'm not a rich guy. I think Ryan's probably a lot richer than me because he's a lawyer. I spent 40 years in design engineering. But we put sweat equity into these airplanes. We spent thousands of hours building these aircraft. They are extremely efficient, and Van's aircraft, as has been mentioned, Richard Van Grunsven started his business in his garage 43 years ago. He has built that business into a multi-million dollar operation headquartered at Aurora, Oregon, and he is the largest and most successful producer of kit airplanes in the world. He markets his kits all over the globe. And he has quite a few direct employees. He has many, many suppliers in his supply chain that are also, you know, have employees. And so you don't see how important aviation is, because even though it's ubiquitous, it's not obvious to non-aviators. There is another operation headquartered in Canby. It's called Advanced Flight Systems, and they produce some of the most advanced avionics, including things like electronic flight information systems, synthetic vision, integration of GPS navigation, collision avoidance, state-of-the-art technology. He has employees. He's merged with Dynon, another leader in advanced avionics. There are many people that would suffer through increasing the cost in avgas. That's a direct hit to customers of kit airplanes like VAN makes. Yeah. Do they care about 30 cents a gallon? You bet they do. They're willing to spend thousands of hours to construct an aircraft and save the money, because, you know, people just can't afford it. And I understand the need for revenue at the state, but it's far better to create revenue positively by encouraging the aviation business and creating jobs and getting the state taxes from employees that are gainfully employed.
You wouldn't mind wrapping up. We still have a number of people behind you.
Thing. Mm-hmm. I would like to say there are other operations a lot of people don't know about. Humanity operations. There's things like Angel Flight. Mm-hmm. There are volunteer pilots who transport very ill people, like cancer patients, from faraway places to get treatment at hospitals because they couldn't get there any other way. They fly tissues, organs, blood for life-saving purposes. Those pilots aren't paid by anybody. They're volunteers. If they get priced out of that, there's going to be less resources available to provide humanitarian services. And there's many things like that.
So unfortunately, we have a whole list of folks that want to speak also. So thank you very much for your testimony today, gentlemen. We appreciate you being here. Next, I'd like to call up Marcia Knoll, John Hay, and it looks like Bob Larson. Did I get that right? Rob Larson. It's either Rob or Bob.
It's Rob.
Rob. Thank you, sir.
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee. My name is Marcia Knoll. I'm a private pilot, and I'm president of the Polk County chapter of the Oregon Pilots Association. There have been many compelling arguments that have already been laid before you, but I would like to point out the discouragement of flight training impacts anybody who buys an airline ticket, relies on firefighting to douse a fire, has a package delivered, in addition to other functions of aviation. Flight training is not provided by the military for the majority of these pilots. In years past, the military had trained many pilots who then went into the commercial airline business and spent the rest of their career there. The military is now demanding that military pilots spend longer after their flight training. The compensation and benefits package has become more lucrative as the airline's compensation and benefits packages has become less lucrative. And there are fewer pilots being trained by the military due to the aircraft that are currently in use. In addition to that, the military is training more drone pilots. The pilots who control the drones do not get any of that credit as flight training. So as a result, the current airline hiring operations is seeing only about 33% of the pilots coming from the military. In order to qualify to fly the UPS, FedEx planes, apply for the airline, it is required to have 1,500 hours of flight experience. Hundreds of those hours are spent in the single and twin engine piston airplanes that rely on the current 100 low lead gas. So it is something that potentially impacts everyone. And certainly our neighbors would be very happy, our neighbor states would be very happy to provide the flight training. and take the business away from hardworking Oregon people and people who have the passion for flight, who would like to learn to fly and become the future airline pilots of the United States.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you for having us here today, Madam Chair and Council members. My name is John Hay. I'm the President and CEO of Hillsborough Aero Academy. We are the largest flight training provider here in the Northwest. And we do airplane and helicopter operations based out of the Hillsborough, Troutdale, and Prineville airports. And I think that I just want to mostly just show my support for what others have said before me regarding my opposition to this House bill. But I also wanted to just add one thing that I think that was stated incorrectly previously by Representative Greenlick, and that is that there is no financial motivation for the other fuel, MoGas. That particular fuel is significantly cheaper, and where you can get it. Some of the aircraft that are out here, they're flying in the GA community, can operate with that fuel. Many of them cannot. So I think it is just taxing the leaded fuel. It doesn't necessarily solve this problem just by putting a tax on and trying to provide a reason to push people away from using that fuel. That financial hurdle is already there, and it's already in place. And it's a matter of making that fuel available where it can be used. And many of the people who are here flying certain types of aircraft cannot use that fuel. They cannot legally use that fuel. And in some cases, my fleet, we can use that fuel. I just wanted to clarify that point and throw in my support for the opposition to this bill.
Thank you so much for being here this afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you for allowing us all to be here today for an issue that for most of us is kind of emotional. My name is Rob Larson, and I'm a local family physician from Silverton. I've practiced medicine in Silverton for 23 years, and I've been a pilot for 40 years. It's my avocation, and it's how I deal with the stresses of medicine. It's also something that I've used professionally. Flying has been something I've done around the state to bring medical care to some of the remote regions that are underserved. For years, I flew to John Day and also to Coos Bay to provide emergency services and hospital services to places that were underserved and hard to get to without an airplane. And the airplane that I own now, if we put the kind of fuel that you are encouraging by this tax, in other words, to get rid of aviation 100 octane fuel, within 5 minutes, my engine will destroy itself and me with it. If you wish to destroy general aviation in the state and to create a danger to pilots, then you should pass this bill. If you wish to promote aviation, then you find ways to encourage it, and that's not by taxing it. I don't think that's ever worked anywhere. So lastly, not all of us are big corporate users of oil. Not all of us have airplanes that are fun toys. Some of us use them in business. Some of them use us for pleasure, for transportation, for our family. I'm one of those. And I would encourage you to vote no against this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Oh, wait, I do. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hillsborough Aviation,
yes,
actually has a huge presence in my district at the Troutdale Airport. And you are, you're part of the helicopter training?
We do airplane and helicopter training both, yes.
So you did say that you could use the other kind of fuel?
And some of, many of the higher octane, or many of the engines that are, many private owners use, mm-hmm, they cannot use that fuel. And there are some aircraft, some types of engines that I operate, not all, but some of them that can be used. My point is that there is already financial incentive, mm-hmm, as about $1 per gallon difference or so between this MoGas and 100 low lead. And I, for our uses, where I know that we've proven that it can be used through history over time, I would be open to switching to that, and I'm actually working with the Port of Portland to do so. It's going to be difficult for us to do that in Troutdale in particular, because there's a whole other infrastructure that needs to be built of storing and delivering and main, you know, everything that goes along with having a third type of fuel at the airport. There happen to be some opportunities to take advantage of some unused tanks in Hillsborough that I'm talking with the Port of Portland about doing so.
Follow up. So there's not that infrastructure right now, though, at Troutdale?
There is not, no.
So do you think that – what kind of impact do you think the proposed bill would have on – since you operate out of Troutdale, what do you think the proposed impact would have on Troutdale?
Well, I think that – The way that I'm prepared to talk about it is really the way that it would impact our customers. I believe our quick analysis is somewhere between $500 and $1,000 additional cost to our customers to go through a training program with this tax versus without this tax. And, of course, that means that people who are not in this state would not experience that. So I'm competing against someone who does not have that tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll call Suzanne Crane, looks like Tori Stinnett, and Ron Sterba.
Not only me, someone else has got to be up here.
Suzanne Crane, my wife. Oh, gosh.
Okay, let's also call Neil White. And looks like we got Rob Larson signed up twice. So, Gary Dunphy. And in any order you choose. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. I appreciate your presence and having the meeting today. My name is Ron Sterba. I've been here to express my opposition to House Bill 3193. I've been an active pilot for 43 years, a member of the Oregon Pilots Association, the Experimental Aircraft Association, and Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. That's nationwide. House Bill 3193 levies a tax on 100 low lead. Let me break that down. Low lead, that fuel has already been reduced once. That's why it's called low lead. So that's an indication that the FAA has been working and they plan to eliminate it here in the future. I find it sort of hard to believe that the bill was sponsored by a person representative in District 33, Northwest Portland, I believe. And I feel that many of the business owners in that district there would not benefit from the increase in taxes because that's rolled over from the schools, the tuition's higher. The people who benefit from these areas are people who have apartment complexes, restaurants, other businesses in the Portland area. So raising the tax is not a good thing. It's already $5. Actually, it came down 50 cents, but $5.45 a gallon here in Salem. It was $6 a gallon. And on the small general aviation aircraft, you're looking at burning an average of 7 gallons an hour in the airplane. So adding an added tax can be a real burden. I would like the fuel to be cheaper. I don't know if it will be, but if we're going to have any favorable outcomes, I'm going to have to say it's the FAA with their new formulas that are mandated, and I look forward to that. I'm going to cut this down a little bit because a lot of the representatives here have spoke about what I've intended to say. I presently fly a 1970s model Cessna Skyhawk. Its value is about $28,000. But the FAA says that once a year I have to have an annual inspection. An annual inspection can run anywhere from several hundred dollars to several thousand dollars, already a burden on the aviator. So with all these inspections, flying is not cheap. Another tax is just another burden. Now, if we're concerned on this bill, I don't know where it's quite balanced here, as one is to generate revenue or one is to generate the knowledge of lead. But I'm going to go ahead and go on lead, because prior to 1975, all of our paint in our buildings here contained lead. And that's a lot of lead. So if you're breathing in an environment...
And if you can wrap up shortly.
It gets to be quite unhealthy. So at this time, I'm going to say, too, if we're going to look at our mercury, look at the Governor Kitzhaber's State of the Union message 2 years ago, where we have lead showing up in the snowpack, and that is lead coming from the fossil fuels burned in the Pacific Rim, coming through the air currents here in Oregon. So please, do not advance this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Madam Chairman, members of the panel, I'm Neil White, here from Salem. And what has addressed earlier has been identified as a punitive tax bill. Marsha Knoll addressed the need for people in general aviation to continue their education. And this punitive bill would decrease the ability for them to get their training. And so I'd like to state a few items from the 2014 Boeing Pilot and Technical Outlook. And as the global economies expand and airlines take deliveries of tens of thousands of new commercial jetliners over the next 20 years, the demand for personnel to fly and maintain those airplanes will be unprecedented. In support of this tremendous growth, the aviation industry will need to supply more than 1 million new commercial airline pilots and maintenance technicians between now and 2033. The 2014 Boeing Pilot and Technician Outlook projects that 533,000 new commercial airline pilots and 584,000 new maintenance technicians will be needed to fly and maintain this worldwide fleet over the next 20 years. You add a punitive measurement to that, and the flight training schools will be drastically impacted. And if we're looking long-term, how are we going to satisfy this global need? It will in truly be a punitive bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Gary Dunphy. I'll try to keep this short. I gave Nathan a copy of what I wrote up this morning. In addition to what I've written up, I've given you a couple ideas that part of our problem, my best guess, is half the pilots in this state would be using non-ethanol fuel today, non-leaded fuel today, if the state in 2007 hadn't made it extremely difficult for us to get the premium non-ethanol summer blend fuel. If the FAA would change its rules that require certified aircraft to use 100 low lead, unless they have an STC, which I understand the EAA owns, there are certain things that we could do to improve things for the environment, and I've written about that. I'm what I call a private pilot. I fly an RB6A. I build it myself. I can do my own inspections and all my own maintenance. I fly predominantly on non-leaded and non-ethanol fuel. And I have to emphasize that non-ethanol. And the state of Oregon, through legislation, I forget what bill, it was House Bill 2210 in 2007, made it very difficult for a lot of pilots to fly with nothing but 100 low lead. They forced a lot of pilots to start using that did not. I fly out of Molino Airport, and what I see is four or five different flight schools that when they leave Hillsboro Airport or Aurora or a lot of the others, a lot of their activities, they spend more time out at Molino and some of the other remote airports than what they do at Hillsboro. They'll depart from Hillsboro, they'll come out and practice their landings and other maneuvers out in the Molino area, and then they'll leave. I see a lot of the training traffic out there, and what I see this bill will do, one main thing, it will take competition, and it'll make costs lower in Washington and California for the student pilots that come here internationally. They can't learn how to fly in Korea. No, it's all military airspace. They can't learn how to fly in China. They come here, and those people come here as students to learn English and how to fly. They're here like tourists for more than a year. Okay, as a tourist, what kind of money did they bring here? Lodging, meals. When they go home, they take a lot of product with them to their families and their friends back home. All that business will leave this state if we have a tax that does nothing but try to punish pilots when it's the FAA and EPA that are doing this. I encourage you to read what I've done. I've flown over 538 kids in my airplane. I love to give them a dream to fly. What can I say? I fly predominantly on non-ethanol, non-leaded fuel. I have a 8.5-to-1 compression. You can run on the premium stuff that's out there. You have a compression less than 9.5-to-1, which is majority of the small planes.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Just, if you don't mind, gentlemen, staying just a second, I'd like to see if the panel has any questions, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Anybody have questions for this panel?
We've done it now.
I think we're covered. I think we've covered the topic. Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. Is there anyone else in the audience that's not signed up that would like to speak to this issue today?
Can I talk from right here?
Sir, I need to have you come up and identify yourself on camera. This is an official committee meeting.
Another gentleman.
Gentlemen, if you'd like to come forward, please do. I'll need you to state your name, and then we'll give you a couple minutes.
Oh, so my name's Thomas E. Downs, and I'm from Fields, Oregon. I'm really here to speak on House Bill 3011.
That's a different bill.
So I know, but after hearing, I didn't realize.
It's a different bill.
I know, but I'm just telling you why I came here and why I would like to speak right now.
To 3193.
Because, 3193.
Right.
Okay, is in Fields, we have pilots fly in, and they want to come in and do that. But the other folks in the audience are probably going to like this, but I'm going to make a choice, and you'll hear this again in other testimonies. I think I'm going to put in a fuel tank with non-ethanol premium fuel, which will allow more pilots to come in. So I've asked pilots, so they're willing to top off their tanks with non-ethanol premium fuel, at least to get home, because it doesn't allow them to fly into fields where we are. So I'm just as a comment is that until everything's up and going, I don't want to lose the business either if we can't have the folks flying with leaded fuel also. But
well, sir, I appreciate you being here. I have spent many a hunting season over in your neck of the woods, and you used to have a cafe that made the best hamburgers within 100 miles.
It still does. It didn't used to. Okay.
I know. That's right where you are, sir. Welcome.
Yep, Madam Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Robert Hall. I'm a pilot. I fly out of Troutdale. And I just sold my light aircraft, which I actually had an STC on my airplane, so I could have used MoGas. But because of water sequestration in ethanol-treated gasoline, I would never use it. Airplane engines don't run well with water in the fuel. The other point I'll make it very briefly, that for a system or an airport like Troutdale, as an example, I have red figures, and I can't quote you the sources right now because it's coming off the top of my head, but it would cost the operator at Troutdale, fixed base operation Gorge Winds, approximately $100,000 to put in an additional tanking system to service that type of a market. And with the FAA mandating biofuels by 2018, we're talking a maximum of 3 years to recover $100,000, you know, for that cost. It just isn't economics. It's coming. It's going to happen. Let's just give it time to have it done. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Welcome, ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Hsu, and I'm a 39-year pilot who started in Oregon 39 years ago. And my interest in general aviation comes from being a flight instructor as well as a designated pilot examiner. We work with a lot of training. I had a training school at one point and a small charter operation. We're being fairly short-sighted, I feel, in this tax, because if we damage general aviation in terms of higher costs, we will also damage the ability to train pilots. The grassroots of general aviation supply the pilots for the airline. We're short on pilots at the airline now. We're adding more airplanes all the time. And if we put the training schools out of business, we will only have higher costs at the airline and fewer airplanes to fly us. So I appreciate you thinking in terms of eliminating this tax or not putting it into existence. Okay. Thank you
so much for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? All right, I believe we have completed our mission for the day on House Bill 3193. I will close the hearing. And I'm going to change the order a little bit. I know we have some folks here who have a ways to go home. So, pardon me? We will be carrying House Bill 2625 over, and we will be moving straight to House Bill 3011. And the hearing is now officially open. Mr. Brennan, give us a little update, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3011 allows the dispensaries for Class 1 flammable liquids.
If we can't even hear what he's saying at all with all this going on.
Well, okay.
Sorry.
The measure allows for dispensaries of Class 1 flammable liquids located in low population areas to permit self-dispensing of such liquids when no owner, operator, or employee of the dispensary is present. The measure has, we have a statement of no revenue impact. There is no fiscal impact statement issued as of yet, and there's no amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Bentz, would you like to join us?
Yes. Madam Chair, I think I have some of my constituents here, but I think they're all signed up. How many do we have?
We have four.
Okay, so we'll wait. I'll finish, and then they can come up.
That's perfect. Thank you.
So this bill has its genesis in realizing that we were not going to have fuel in many parts of.
Representative Bentz, would you like to identify yourself?
60.
Thank you.
And I'm going to point out District 60, which you can see up on the screen. And just to give everybody an idea of what's happening, I have this little handy pointer. If you come out of Ontario, out here to Vail, you can then go up toward John Day in this area. There used to be service stations about every 30 miles along this route. Most of them are now closed.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily because, well, people get better gas mileage, but also because you can't afford to keep them open. So if you come down this road, this is Highway 20 going over to Burns. You'll find out here that Harper is the last fuel, and then you have about 68 miles to go with no fuel. There is a road that runs from Burns down here to Burns Junction, and we have folks from Burns Junction with us today. This is Jordan Valley. There's fuel here, but there's no fuel here at Burns Junction, and you'll hear why. This is McDermott, and there's fuel at McDermott, but basically nothing in this stretch now. That's a really long way to hear how far that is. There's a road here, of course, that goes down to Lakeview, and is another, this is down to Lakeview, and another extremely long stretch with no fuel. There used to be some here at Wagentire, but no longer. And, of course, this road is Riley, and there's still fuel here at Riley, but you can drive a long ways past Hampton Station and Brothers. Maybe there'll be fuel there, maybe not. But, again, it's because there's not enough traffic to warrant paying someone to guard the fuel tanks all the time. So the purpose of this bill is to set up a rural arrangement where people out in these areas can stop and fuel their own cars if the population is such that, well, there's nobody there. That's basically the long and short of it. I was kind of surprised because I was looking at the largest city in my area is basically Ontario, and that has 11,300 people. The people per square mile in Baker County has the most, 5.3, and Harney County has the least, 0.71 persons per square mile. That's to be compared to Multnomah County, which is 1,704 people per square mile. The idea here is that we would put into place two control features, the first one being a city of a certain size, and then everything below that number would be deemed to be rural. So it would be simple enough to put the number at a pretty modest number. We wouldn't want to be allowing self-serve in all of the larger towns, so to speak, in the area, but we certainly would want to have the opportunity in the smaller ones. And of course, when it comes to people per square mile, our recommendation would be somewhere around 8. And that should allow people in most areas to have that fuel available. I know the testimony that you're going to hear will illustrate just how challenging it is to maintain a business when you have to pay someone by the hour to be out there. You simply can't because there's too few people coming by. But nonetheless, we still need fuel out in these areas. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to take questions, but turn it over to my.
Thank you, Representative Bentz. I can attest to the fact that there's some long stretches out there, because I've been on every road that you pointed out, and it's beautiful, beautiful country, but we do have an issue, so thank you for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
I would like to call up Mr. Gene Kinsey and David Dickerson. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, I'm here.
You've come a long way, sir.
Yeah, I started at 4 o'clock.
I'll bet you did.
On ice over 100 miles.
Well, thank you for taking the time to come testify this afternoon. Gentlemen?
I'm Gene Kinsey. And even though my wife and I live presently in eastern Washington, we own property at Burns Junction because my mother passed away and it wound up in our care. Mm-hmm. So I think we've covered this young man over here is pretty well covered, because you can't afford to keep somebody, you can't afford to pay somebody to stay for the hours that you need. And yet when you look, can I read a little bit of what I've written?
Because you may, sir.
I'm not a polished speaker.
You're doing just fine, but you certainly
may. But I can tell you this, you know, finding the right person to run those pumps is extremely difficult when you have a very low population. You have many more cows, and a cow is not going to run that gas station. So anyway, When the hours are sufficient, and needing gas is the highest it's really the highest on a midsummer day, but it's not when it's cold wintertime. The traffic is so low you can't afford to have somebody run a pump. So, and I think this young man talked about that. So anyway, I do remember vaguely having my mother hired somebody for the weekends, because that was when the traffic went through. But since my mother passed away, I think it was in 2002 or somewhere in there, 2002, well, there's been nobody that the Burns Junction has been flat out. No operation there. So one of the things that I wrote up here is a special point to consider is that if a winter traveler coming out of Jordan Valley and the weather is really bad, they miss the sign, the next gas is 100 miles, McDermott. And if they miss that sign, the running out of gas at night and in the cold can be definitely life-threatening. Mm-hmm. So having a car-operated fuel station in a shorter distance than 100 miles can be a lifesaver. Mm-hmm. Some of the businesses that are along the way, like there is a business at Rome, and they're having difficulty trying to stay afloat because they can't afford this. They have the same problems that everybody else does in such a remote area. Mm-hmm.
So that's not too far from Three Forks, right?
Pardon?
That's out near Three Forks.
Yes, yes, beautiful. Beautiful place. Yes, I know. I've seen it on the map, but I want to go there sometime.
You need to go there.
But I'm not going to go there without a full tank of gas.
Smart man. Very smart man. It's a long hill you got to go down.
Yeah. So anyhow, at the end of this, I wrote, I love to explore. And having a car operations in fields in Rome and other locations would make it possible for myself and many others to enjoy this beautiful place in our country. So huge. It's bigger than some of the eastern states. Silver City is one of the places, and the only way to get there is through Jordan Valley, but it's in Idaho. But in other places, you want to go with exploring with good weather and a full tank of gas. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank Mr. Bentz, because he's the one that's invited me to come down here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate you being here.
Opportunity to talk. And then this young man here.
Mr. Dickerson.
Mr. Dickerson.
Welcome to our committee, sir.
Okay.
You're on.
Okay, I own property out there. And I'm tired of having to drive Jordan Valley to get gas and come back when I get short. That's a 90-mile round trip when I could just pull out there to a junction that's 8 miles from me, gas her up, and be off and going. And also, I have people banging on my door all night long. I'm out of gas. Mm. These people don't realize how far it is between gas out there. And I ask them, well, what direction did you come from? Well, we come from California. There's a gas station every 2 or 3 miles. We are not in California here. And I have them want to know if they can siphon gas out of my tank. Well, how am I supposed to get to town and function? And some of them do anyway, when I'm not looking. So I think it's time that Oregon joins the rest of the United States and has self-service gas.
At least in that area.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for this panel?
So good. Thank you.
You know, I might ask, we have card lock systems where I live for commercial purposes. So could this be set up in a similar way as we use a card lock system? Yes, Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, no, in a word, because what we're looking for here, people are coming through, they won't have, right. they won't belong to that system, generally speaking. I mean, there are certain trucking systems and things you can join, but this right. these are people true. That just happen to drive by having no idea how far it is from McDermott through to Jordan Valley. They don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
And that area is extremely cold in the winter and extremely hot and really, really dry in the summer. There's no water out there. There's nothing. And so you have to, when we talk about cars, we're talking about credit cards. And it would be a normal pump and run by a credit card. And hopefully we'd have somebody nearby so they wouldn't destroy things. But it wouldn't be a situation where there would be anybody able to run out. In fact, what you'd have to do is stay in your shop if you're brave enough to have it unlocked that late at night, with a lot of very different sort of folks come through that area, and many different motives for driving those late hours at night, most of them bad. But the point is, we'd rather have them fill up and move on down the road using a credit card.
Okay.
And so you might well lock your doors to keep them out. And I'm not even joking.
I hear you.
But the trick is to get them on through. And I'm sure this is a very small percentage of our clientele down there, but nonetheless, still a problem. But we do need to have fuel. And this is just the Jordan Valley Road. The same is true on the Lakeview Road. The same is true on the Burns Highway. Every place out in those remote and remote areas.
Thank you.
But again, it's not a card lock.
Okay. No. Different setup.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. I'd like to call up Mr. Romaine and Mr. Downs. Welcome back, Mr. Downs.
Yeah.
And Mr. Romaine, you're the only one that is less than 100 miles away. So
here's some little propaganda.
Oh, thank you.
Cool.
Hey, I've been everywhere. Yeah. Thank you. That's great.
Oh, look at it. This is something you might relate to.
This letter? Okay.
Thank you.
So that will have to come into play.
Mr. Downs, why don't you begin, please?
Okay. So my name's Thomas E. Downs, and Fields, Oregon. We own the Fields Station, my wife and I, Sandy. So we have a letter that I'm submitting. We left Easter Sunday to make it to this hearing. We usually got Easter service, so we kind of had to cancel that. But so this letter that you'll see has to do with a group of folks that were stranded at our service station because we close Easter Sunday. So I'll start with a point that you talked about, the card lock. So I've investigated what will happen with the card thing, and to convert my dispensers over to pump fuel 24 hours a day, I have a quote for $26,000 so it'll be able to read Visa, MasterCards, and all that. And you'd be able to do it with business locked up. So, I mean, that's quite an investment. That's why I'll come back to
My choice is to put in non-ethanol premium. I can get, for that amount of money, I can put in a pump that the folks would only have a choice of one fuel after hours. But I'll go back to experiences we've had. We have a great working relationship with our law enforcement folks. In, we're not on the map there. So you can't... So there's a road 205. But anyway, they have to respond to, we've had numerous vehicle accidents, four-wheeler accidents. We have the Alvar Desert. There's airplanes, gliders. But so they don't have enough fuel to return. Or if they got another call, all they could do is zoom to Burns to get fuel. So we have been woken up at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, or told early on that they'll have to refuel after they do their investigation, which... They may end up down there at 8 o'clock at night, or and it may take into the wee hours of the morning. So we have to get up to do that. We've had the same reference in the middle of winter. If you've ever seen somebody hysterical because it's freezing cold, they've called 911 that the dispatchers have called us to get up and provide fuel for them, and they're scared to death. So, and the other bad part of this new stuff is these new fancy phones. And people are stupid. they drive by. So the new phones, if they're traveling from Seattle to Las Vegas, vice versa, anywhere north-south route, the new phones direct them as a shortcut right through Highway 205. So they do that. And they also shortcut you around towns because there's a way to bypass Burns and Hines. And then the same thing when they hit Winnemucca, Nevada. They bypass around, and those people do not deviate from that phone, or they print a Google Map page, and people are just, they get scared. And if they don't follow that, and they'll drive right by gas stations until the light comes on in their car, and then they're worried. So we run into this all the time, you know, so... We basically need to do, and on page, was it 42 in here, you can look at the tractions from Burns and the mileages you'll have to travel to do that. And folks, you know, they spend time in fields to enjoy the outback, as they call it. And the other thing we lost was Denial, Nevada, Denial Junction. They lost their fuel capacity, so now we have the 140 route where a lot of folks also do that. So the need for self-service in our country, or part of the state, and, you know, throughout the state, I don't know, so I just throw out, you know, if we honor driver's license as a reciprocatory thing, I don't understand why out-of-staters can't pump their own fuel. If we need to limit the Oregonians because we're not capable of handling fuel, then maybe we ought to just pass the law that allows out-of-staters to pump their own fuel anytime. So, I mean, we figure they can drive. So, anyway.
Mr. Downs,
so it's
your point is very well taken. I have spent quite a bit of time down at Agnes on the Rogue River, and we've had occasion where a GPS will improperly direct a driver up over Bear Camp, and with some very significant result when that road's closed and they don't know it, and the weather comes in, and it can be a fuel issue. You run out of gas, then you do freeze because your car can't stay warm because you're stuck. And I understand the ramifications of the things that you're talking about. They're serious. You know, we're kind of lighthearted here, but these are serious issues. So thank you so much for bringing this issue to us. Representative Bentz.
I'm sure I just wanted to point out right where he's from. See right there, that's that little dot right there. Oh. That's Fields. And then right down, there's Denial right there.
Wow.
Been there.
And then there's this road that drives at an angle down below McDermott right up here to Denial and then on up. And that's what he's talking about, I think. People that circle, they don't even get to McDermott and coming out of Winnemucca. And so, yes. Do I have that right?
Yeah, they cut one. Well, to go, the GPS, or the, you know, Google takes right. them right up to 140, and then they come up our route,
right.
which is county roads, till you hit State Highway 205.
Yeah.
Technology has its place, but there are times when it fails miserably, and this is one of them.
That's for sure.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Romain, you're the only one that's less than 100 miles, so you get to go last.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Romain. I'm here representing the Oregon Fuels Association with my daughter, we're part of the Romain Group, catchy name. And we represent the wholesalers and retailers of fuel in the state. And self-service, as you well know, is an issue that's been around for quite a while. Every year we think we're getting a little bit closer to maybe some rational thought about it here in the state. It's become almost like a religious issue. It's very difficult to talk about it. There are believers and non-believers, and you can't really get the two together. But there are certain basic things, first of all. First of all, it was put in, basically, self-service, the ban on it was not put in for safety reasons. It was put in to keep the big oil companies from owning the retail stations. That's the reason it came in. It was actually requested by the Gasoline Dealers Association in the 50s. And the big oil companies don't own retail stations anymore, especially in Oregon, because there's no money in retail. Retail is very low margin. That's number one. Number two, it's safety. A confession here. The last person to blow up a gas station was my wife, and that's serious. She was not my wife, and I don't know if I would have married her if I would have known, but seriously, what happened was she pulled up at a station, and it was full service. Person came to the window. She gave the person a credit card, or actually, fill it up. He filled it up. He came back out. He said, that'll be whatever. She gave a credit card. He went back in the place because it wasn't on the pump at the time. He ran it. He came back out. He gave her the card. She signed for it. He tore it off, gave it to her. She did all the stuff, closed the window, and drove off. Unfortunately, he had not taken the clothes out. And it was before the breakaway, and
wow.
It fell over. Fire trucks come. They foam down the station. They literally had to dig up the whole station.
Oh, wow.
So that was not her fault. And it's also rather amusing. You're making light, but it is funny. In Washington State, it's an amusement with station operators up there. They sit there. They watch when people from Oregon pull up. And they have like a timer on. How long are they going to sit in the car before they realize they have to actually get out? And it's actually funny to watch people operate that way. And for all of us are guilty of that. We pull in. The problem is that there are certain areas of the state, Eastern Oregon, frankly, parts of the coast, where you go a long distance between gas stations. And that's fine if you're smart enough to fill up your tank whenever you get close to half, but it's not smart in most areas of the outer parts of the state. We need to do something. And I think what Representative Bentz has proposed and this committee is considering is a good step forward. We need to refine what the requirements are. Frankly, we had talked about this issue over with the Fuels Association over the last year. And we even talked to the Retail Clerks Union, who's in favor of this. They're fine with it. The reason for it is you end up with areas where there is no gasoline. Plus, for us to keep a station open, the cost of the gas to the retail consumer in a small market area is very large because the cost of having that station is the same whether you're in serving 20 people or 20,000 people. The cost of the physical station and the people you need there is going to be about the same. You're just going to pay a lot more if we keep the station open. So I think by doing something along these lines, and maybe we get together and try and figure out the exact language of the bill and maybe where it should cover, would be a good step forward. Now, do remember this is fraught with political issues, and it mainly comes from the population centers of Oregon. The last person to bring a bill to the floor of the House was Representative Randy Miller. Mm-hmm. At the time, he brought it to the floor, actually got it out of committee. Representative Greenlick actually voted for it at almost the cost of his marriage. And they brought it to the floor, and they brought it back to committee, and Randy made the statement that it looked like they were one quarter of being one quarter of the way there. And with the amount of support. But something that's limited, that was statewide. This is much more limited. And this makes a lot of sense. And frankly, in the long run, maybe it'll get people to understand that this really isn't a bad thing to have. It's okay. So we would greatly support it. We'd love to work with Representative Benz on exact language, and we commend you for bringing this forward. This is a real good thing. And we will work with you very closely trying to get the Senate to consider this as you pass it through there.
Questions for these gentlemen? Vice Chair Gorsuch.
One question. We were sitting here wondering, in other states, when a station is closed, do they have the capability of still using a card if there's no one there and it's a self-serve state?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, if the station is self-serve, it's usually always open.
Okay.
Yes, well, I've been in Utah, and we...
Yeah.
I was dumb and let the gas get real low, and same thing. So we were able to just pull up to a closed station, put in the credit card, bingo, and off we went.
And there are parts of Eastern Oregon where you do have self-service. They're called reservations. You do at the casino in outside of Pendleton. Hmm. It's self-service. Again, I was one who sat there for a little while. I realized I was at a casino.
Guilty too.
An hour goes by, and you're like, where is that?
I remember the days when I used to wander that country often, and we had a pickup and we put dual tanks on it. Do people still do that?
Oh, yeah, there's gas cans.
We always had dual tanks on our truck, so, you know, but I didn't know if that was a common practice anymore, yeah. Anyway.
Like I said, it's the new phones. We're getting a whole flow of traffic through there. Right. Just no idea.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
I just wanted to take the advantage and show you where I grew up, which was right there.
All right.
Because you're a fielder.
Our post office. Field,
So you do have really good hamburgers. I know that.
Still do.
Questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you all for coming such a long distance to talk to us about this issue. We're grateful.
50 miles.
You did.
Well, okay.
I'm not talking to you, Paul.
Keep fighting.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to this issue that we haven't called on? All right. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3011. And we are carrying over 2625. So we are opening a hearing on House Bill 3256. Mr. Brennan.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3256 establishes the Infrastructure Matching Fund to allow the Department of Transportation to provide grants to local governments for transportation projects. It directs the Department to create an Infrastructure Matching Program to provide the matching grants to the local governments with monies from the fund. And it has an appropriation from the general fund of $25 million for purposes of the program. It also has an emergency clause to become effective upon passage. And this measure, I should also point out, has subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Davis. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair.
Enlighten us, please.
And thank you, members of the committee. I am State Representative John Davis. It's a pleasure to be before you today, and I feel like Patrick Brennan stole all my thunder because this is a pretty darn, pretty darn simple bill.
The purpose
of the bill, as detailed in Section 2, Lines 18 to 20, is to provide matching grants to local governments for transportation projects. And transportation projects, as defined under Section 1, Line 6, really is any mode of transportation. So many of you know, many of us know about the Connect Oregon program, which is for non-highway and non-road transportation funds. And we've funded that with lottery bonds. I think, are we on our fifth now, or is this going to be our sixth? Coming up on six. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of this program, the Infrastructure Matching Program, would be to specifically provide for transportation funding on a matching basis to local governments. And it stems from a couple of items. It stems from the fact that I was astounded when I entered the legislature to find how little of our tax money that we pay in income taxes to the general fund is actually used on transportation. As best I can tell, because I've looked at a number of budgets, it's about $10 million total of our $18.5 billion general fund. So most of my constituents believe that when they're writing their checks, either as businesses or as individual taxpayers, to the general fund of the state of Oregon, that they're paying for schools, roads, and public safety first. And are distraught to learn when I tell them that actually, no, you don't pay almost anything It's hard to even come up with a percentage of what you pay in terms of infrastructure and roads from our general taxes, what we think we're paying for. And then it's all primarily from the gas tax and a little bit from lottery bonding through Connect Oregon. So the purpose of House Bill 3256 is both to, I think, right what I see as a wrong in that regard, to start the process of making good on the fact that transportation is a fundamental need that needs to be met by the state, and also to provide some compensation to local governments who, although many of them fund, all of them fund transportation at the local level, and that comes from local taxation and in part from the gas tax, which is really a derivative of population in those local governments. They're also bearing a burden statewide of travelers from Oregon who come through local communities, who use infrastructure. In some instances, as we've just heard, some small communities that really bear a lot of out-of-town traffic and don't have any of those out-of-towners paying into their local infrastructure. And that's why the focus of House Bill 3256 is on local governments. Finally, I'll just mention that the matching portion is important to me, because I found that in our programs that we run as a state and the ones that I see nationwide that provide a matching element are often some of the most effective. And that's because when you require someone's skin in the game, they'll only make asks that are real. When we offer programs that provide 100% incentive, everybody comes out of the woodwork and everybody wants a dollar. When we ask people or governments or private entities to put some of their own skin in the game, it provides an automatic weed out of projects that are not viable. Here, the limit would be 50% of the total cost of the project could be financed from the infrastructure matching program and infrastructure matching fund. The rest could be a combination match of the local government dollars or of private dollars. And I think provides an equitable basis upon which we can say, yes, if you come and make a grant application for these funds and you're willing to put 50 cents on the dollar up, this is probably a program and a project that's worth doing. So with that, I just thank you. Well, I'll take any technical questions. We may or may not have some people who are coming to speak about this bill, but thank you for your time.
Thank you, Vice Chair Davis.
Yes,
Representative McLean.
I think this is technical.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Washington County has their own dollars,
yes,
in the program. So would that, were those dollars be matching dollars? Where do they have to come from? They can come from any of the funds?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative McLean. Yes, there's no specification on where the matching dollars could come from.
Okay.
So a couple of, and I'm really glad you mentioned the Washington County example, because it could come from a general fund of local governments, it could come from dedicated transportation funding of local governments, or frankly, in many instances, when you have a development coming online, you have the developer who's paying very substantial development fees, and it could come from those private funds as well.
Representative Lively.
So, Representative Davis, my question would be, so is this program meant to supplement programs we already have, for example, the Immediate Opportunity Fund, which provides funds, and there's also some infrastructure funds, which many of them are grants in that through the Economic Development Department. So this is in addition to those current, or is this to replace those?
Yes, through the chair, thank you, Representative Lively, for the question. Yes, this would be in addition to those programs. The programs you're mentioning, I believe, are primarily housed in Business Oregon, and I believe primarily focus on the non-transportation infrastructure. We've heard testimony, I think, in this committee about sewer projects and non-transportation infrastructure. So the focus of this would be to supplement those programs and to focus on transportation infrastructure.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Chair, Speaker.
Ooh.
I don't know.
Whoever you are.
Elevated.
Compliment
to
you.
Congratulations.
I don't know.
It's the end of the day. I'm getting tired.
couple questions.
Well, I will. ODE will be, or Department of Transportation, ODE, boy, I really am tired. The Department of Transportation will decide who gets these funds. Will that be a process set up through them? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hack, thank you for that question. Yes, this would be a very similar process to the Connect Oregon process, which is run by the Oregon Transportation Commission. We fund it, we set some guidelines in statute and as a legislature, and then the Transportation Commission, which is a very experienced body at funding transportation projects. They put together our STIP, our transportation plan. And so they know, frankly, at the detail level, they know as a body a lot about our transportation needs. They would make the grant decisions at that level.
Okay, follow up.
Yes, ma'am.
Do we know what the dollar amount will be? Is there a cap that each grant will be given up to a certain amount, matching at 50%? Is that going to be in the rulemaking process, or do you know if is it going to be up to X amount of dollars per county? Do we have any idea?
Through the chair, Representative Hack, thank you for the question. It doesn't specify in the statute. My intent would be both the criteria geographically and grant-wise would be similar to Connect Oregon. And Connect Oregon does have equitability in terms of across the state. And I don't think it has caps on project size. And we see projects anywhere, and ODOT, if they come up to testify, can speak to that. I think Connect has seen projects as low as in the hundreds of thousands and as high as in the double-digit millions for single grant applications.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
Thanks so much.
I'd like to call up Gwen Baldwin, Craig Honeyman, and Paul Mather, please. Thank you for your patience. It has been a full afternoon.
Definitely for me.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair McKeown and members of the committee, I will be really brief. I'm here, Gwen Baldwin, representing the city of Beaverton. We like this.
Okay,
I'll
give you wow. We can close the hearing.
Here we go. Get the award for the briefest, most positive testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Baldwin.
Yeah. It's simple. It's additive, as Representative Davis said. The need is significant, and I know this committee is highly aware. It's flexible. It leverages dollars, which I think we all know can sometimes bring things creatively to fruition. So this is a great bill.
Great. Thank you.
Representative McEwen, members of the committee, I'm Craig Honeyman with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll associate myself with the Ms. Baldwin's remarks and express our gratitude to Representative Davis for bringing this bill. The League supports it. Frankly, the League supports any legislation when it dealing with transportation infrastructure that enhances the opportunity for cities to manage a declining infrastructure. And I think we all are too well aware of some of the uncertainties, both at the state level and certainly at the federal level, in terms of additional revenues going forward. Cities have tools. Make no mistake about it. We have tools, as has already been mentioned by Representative Davis, that we can use: gas tax, transportation utility fees, systems charges, et cetera. But the shortfall, both in terms of maintenance and preservation budgets and the opportunity to invest in capital projects to enhance the system is huge. And so an effort like this we think would be is a positive step, and we look forward to working with you, members of the committee, Representative Davis, certainly the Oregon Transportation Department and their commission to make this program work if you decide to send it out of the legislature. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for being here. Mr. Mather, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Just a couple of quick comments. You've heard us talk up here on numerous occasions about the needs in transportation, whether it's our roads or bridges, culverts. So any transportation funding would help deal with the vast needs that we have in transportation. The other thing you've heard us talk about is the need to get funding to all modes of transportation. We have the Highway Trust Fund. We have the federal funds. Each comes with their own restrictions. General funds would be a new tool in the toolbox that would allow us to get to transportation needs that are restricted from those other funding. Outside of that, just here for any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I will close the hearing on... Anyone else want to speak to this? Yes, come on up. That's fine.
Oh, that little thing. $25 million.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Nancy Metella with Tax Fairness Oregon, and we love this bill. In all respects, except where the funds come from. The general fund has been robbed over and over and over again, and perhaps that's too strong a word to use. But absolutely, transportation is essential to a good economy and to make this state great, even greater. The problem is it will be at the expense of education and human services, and so we cannot support it for that reason. And that's all I have to say.
Great. Thank you very much for
Thank
your testimony
you.
This afternoon.
Thank you.
And unless there's anyone else who would like to speak to this bill, I will close the hearing on House Bill 3256. Mr. Brennan, we have a busy day on Wednesday, I think.
Yes, Madam Chair. Let me just real quick grab my line up here. So Wednesday, we're going to have work sessions on our two film tax credit bills that we had heard earlier in the session. We have two bills dealing with transportation network companies that we're going to have scheduled for public hearing. I believe the plan is to schedule those, hear those jointly. We're also going to hear a bill dealing with the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. That bill is going to have a Gut and Stuff amendment. So if you see that on OLIS, keep in mind that there will be a forthcoming Gut and Stuff amendment on that bill. We're going to have hear a bill about TriMet board appointees and also membership of the ATV Vehicle Grant Subcommittee.
It's going to be a very busy day, so we will be beginning early, and hopefully we'll finish on time if we're lucky. So, thank you all. On that note, we're adjourned. Thank you all. On that note, we're adjourned.